I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The crisis deepens in Egypt 6 days after President Mohamed Morsi was removed from power by the military. This was following days of mass public protest against his government and the Muslim Brotherhood. Yesterday, there was a mass shooting of Morsi supporters who were protesting his ouster and detention. More than 50 people are dead and hundreds are injured. The protesters are blaming security forces, while the army and police are blaming Morsi's Islamist backers. There are growing concerns about more violent confrontations, even civil war. Meanwhile, last night, Egypt's interim president announced new elections would be held at the beginning of 2014 in hopes of quelling the unrest. The Muslim Brotherhood has rejected that timetable. Joining us from Jerusalem is Kevin Connolly, Middle East correspondent for the BBC. He was in Egypt for a week, left yesterday. And Kevin Connolly, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
What do we know about what sparked yesterday's violent attack?
Well, trying to reconstruct the precise factual circumstances of those kind of incidents in Egypt is extraordinarily difficult. Most of these things happen under the cover of darkness. There are huge crowds on the streets because, I suppose, one thing which we can say clearly about Egypt at the moment is that it's decided to transact its politics, to fight for the future of its soul, if you like, on the streets. So politics for now, at least, has more or less been abandoned. So you have enormous crowds out. There are always scenes of great confusion. There are rival crowds. Sometimes they're milling around in the center of that vast city. Sometimes they focus on different points where they have their own strongholds or places to which they have their own emotional ties. That would be a mosque for the Islamists, Tahrir Square for the people who oppose the Islamists. That incident took place, and I was there just a few hours later, at a military building where the Islamists, the Muslim Brotherhood, they believe that the deposed President Mohamed Morsi certainly was held in the immediate aftermath of his removal last week. He may not still be there, but they see that as a symbolic place. It's heavily defended by the army. The precise circumstances of how those events unfolded still a matter of deep dispute. Like everything else in Egypt, the army says that the crowd pushed forward, ignoring attempts to restrain it peacefully, and that eventually the troops were forced to open fire because they themselves came under attack from what they describe as terrorists associated with the protesters. The Islamist protesters, they say that the troops opened fire on them while they were at prayer. There's no clear video evidence that really definitively supports either case. And one of the problems with Egypt, and when you get to this level of polarization anywhere, of course, is that people will believe whatever they wish to believe. They will take away from whatever every incident, whatever they want to take away to reinforce their own prejudices. And every time one of those incidents happens, the place becomes edgier, more divided, and potentially more violent.
Well, this was, as I understand it, the deadliest attack in Egypt in the last 2 years. Do you see this, Kevin, as a kind of turning point in this country?
I don't, is the honest truth, because it was a very similar incident, albeit with slightly lower loss of life the previous week. And as I say, the danger is that Egypt has crossed a kind of political and historical Rubicon. It had an opportunity, albeit a very brief one, to create democratic institutions after decades of military rule. That was the most desirable outcome, I suppose, if you like, of what we still call the Arab Spring, that uprising that began in the February of 2011. But in effect, that attempt to shift the country very suddenly towards democracy is stalling. And while it's stalling, and while anger and passion grow on both sides of the argument, the place will become very dangerous. As I say, in effect, both sides see the opportunity to get what they want through the politics of the street. And, you know, in a generally volatile place where there's tremendous poverty, there's tremendous overcrowding in Cairo, there's a tremendous sense of anger that there's a really historical moment here, a tremendous amount at stake for both sides. It seems to me that violence, in the short term at least, is more or less inevitable, and that's what we've been seeing over the course of the last week. I mean, because of the way in which we report around the clock in the modern news industry, I've slightly lost count of how many people have died, but it would be much more than 100, I think, in the last week in Cairo alone, with dozens more perhaps in other major Egyptian cities. You know, this is a hugely important country in the Middle East, going through what will, I think, turn out to be a defining moment of crisis, and that's a dangerous time for everybody.
I'm curious about what it is like to navigate the streets of Cairo, whether you see an enhanced military and police presence, whether there are checkpoints, whether it looks in any way like there's martial law, or is it more chaos and confusion?
Well, it changes from day to day. Last Thursday, I was out around Cairo Zoo, which is on the way up between from our office to Cairo University, and that will be an important gathering point for young students who are Islamists, who support the Muslim Brotherhood. So on the way up to see them and to spend the day with them on Thursday, we encountered, I think we counted at one point, 47 military vehicles with their attendant crews. And they're all military vehicles, of course, that would be very familiar to your audience there on the east coast of the United States, because they all basically come from America's aid program to the Egyptian army. So plenty of American main battle tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles are out and about. The next day, we made the same journey again to spend the Friday prayer hour with these young men that we'd made to create some sort of relationship with, and there wasn't a single troop to be seen anywhere on the streets, because the army had decided that a lower profile at that point made better sense. But around any military building, and there are a lot of them in Cairo because the army is a very important force in Egyptian society, you will find barbed wire defenses, you will find troops. Checkpoints aren't designed to stop people like me, but there are checkpoints there to try to allow the army to work out who is going where as they move around Cairo. And during the worst of the fighting last week on the 6th of October bridge that leads into Tahrir Square, where the Islamists and their rivals were fighting pitched battles, at one point while we were there, there were military vehicles driving pretty crazily to us up and down the bridge between the two sides, trying to keep them apart. There was plenty of live gunfire, a lot of fireworks, which make it hard to work out exactly how much live gunfire you're hearing. Plenty of tear gas, plenty of stone throwing. As I say, they're dangerous times when both sides feel that the future of Egypt is up for grabs, and that, you know, democracy has failed to deliver a satisfactory outcome from either side. And so now, as I say, for the moment, Egypt is transacting its politics in this very dangerous and rather destabilizing way on the streets.
And is all of this just happening in Cairo, or are there other protests and even violent confrontations in other parts of Egypt?
Yeah, Egypt's second city is up on the Mediterranean. It's a place called Alexandria, an ancient, really ancient center of culture and civilization. You can find the historical roots there of everybody from Alexander the Great, obviously, through Cleopatra, Napoleon, Winston Churchill. I mean, Alexandria is a very, very important historical city in the Middle East and in Africa. The 12 dead there in really extensive and really vicious rioting one night last week. I mean, I've heard the odd report of other deaths there. Alexandria would always be a dangerous and deeply divided place itself. And I mean, I think what is really happening here, if you take a step back from it, is that, as I say, after 60 years of military rule, and that came on top of decades of British colonial occupation, Egypt tried to transition very, very quickly to democracy. And if you're an American diplomat or a British or French diplomat, you would argue that, you know, when something similar happened in Eastern Europe and occupation and dictatorship ended, transitioning to democracy very quickly worked and helped the place to become stable. But there is a very awkward argument to be had about countries like Egypt that's too quick a transition to democracy. I mean, there's more to being a democracy than simply conducting elections. And although, you know, it's very easy and very dangerous to look like a patronizing Western outsider in Arab society, the truth of the matter is that Egypt perhaps tried too quickly to hold elections. A very, very sharp and polarizing choice was offered of president. One of the candidates was a guy from the old regime, an Air Force general. The other was a figure from the Muslim Brotherhood. And it was the Brotherhood that won by a whisker, and they saw that victory as a mandate to make Egypt something much more resembling an Islamist society. But that is not a model with which many Egyptians are comfortable. There are plenty of Egyptians who are convinced and faithful Muslims who don't want to live in an Islamist society. And, of course, there's a very large Christian minority in Egypt as well. So the criticism of the regime that's just been ousted was that it was a wafer-thin mandate. It was trying to impose rather fundamental changes for which Egyptian people simply weren't ready. And so that rapid democratization, as I suppose we would have to see it, in Egypt has not really worked. And I think the danger of the announcements of the last 24 hours, where we're talking about running to, you know, new elections again in a year, is that the same thing might happen all over again. But of course, there's no desirable outcome on the horizon. I mean, either you don't hold elections, in which case the place begins to look like a military dictatorship again, or you do hold them and you run the risk of repeating this whole cycle all over again.
A couple of more questions before we have to say goodbye to you, but would it be fair and could you say that then the protesters largely support what the military did when it deposed Morsi?
Well, it's a very difficult argument if you are one of those people who described as a young revolutionary, because, of course, I mean, we always describe them as Democrats or liberals, in a sort of rather, you know, we need rather sort of lazy instant labels for people in the American and the British media. So they were certainly very pleased that Mohamed Morsi was no longer president. But on the other hand, it's a bit paradoxical as a Democrat to support, you know, what certainly looks and feels like a military coup, even if the United States government isn't prepared to come out and say it's a military coup for various technical and legal American political reasons. So for the Democrats, as long as this is quick, I think they can live with it. If you're an Islamist, you believe that this is part of a long sort of historical tradition that goes back to Iran in the 1950s or Algeria in the 1990s, whereby any time someone with whom, you know, with strong Islamic credentials wins an election, the election victory is stolen from them by men in uniform. And so they would certainly see a very direct parallel with Algeria in the 1990s. And they are angry. They say it's a straightforward military coup, and they're extremely angry. I mean, I had a lot of problems with various people who wanted to stop me and talk to me on the way to the airport yesterday. They are very angry with Western countries for supporting the Egyptian army and coming in and removing their man from power.
Well, and a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, Kevin, but does anyone know where deposed President Mohamed Morsi is?
Well, in a very broad sense, we do. He's in military custody. Quite where they put him, we don't know. And there are lots of rumours sweeping the country that the military might find a way to try him for treason. And that, I think, would make an already dangerous and volatile situation even more dangerous and volatile. But of course, having removed him from power and put him in custody, the army has made an enormous problem for itself in deciding what to do with him. So, you know, it's certainly much easier to see the problems than the opportunities in modern Egypt. As I say, it looks and feels like a volatile and dangerous place. It's an enormous problem in the Middle East because it's such an enormously important country. It's also a huge problem for American foreign policy because so much of American strategy in the Middle East is about trying to engineer some kind of stability. And Egypt has always been the stable bit of the Middle East for the Americans since the 1970s. And now it really isn't.
Well, we're going to pick up on that with our two guests waiting in the wings. Kevin Conley, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
You're welcome.
And he's Middle East correspondent for the BBC. He joined us from Jerusalem and spent the last week until yesterday in Egypt. And as I said, two guests waiting in the wings as we continue our conversation talking about the crisis in Egypt. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington supports WHYY and presents French Twist, masterworks of photography from Atjeh to Man Ray, on view through September 15th. Featuring vintage black-and-white prints from the golden age of French photography, this exhibition includes pioneering photojournalism, lyrical views of Paris streets and gardens, notorious creatures of the night, and surrealist experiments. For more information, 302-571-9590 or delart.org.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Alfredo Corchado, who spent years covering the violence of drug cartels in Mexico. Once at a restaurant in Laredo, Texas, two young men came in with a warning.
One of them takes his hand out and points at me and does like he was using a gun. Bam, bam, bam.
Corchado's new memoir is called Midnight in Mexico. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Next time in Studio 360, the Civil War battle that's still going on.
I wish I...
People now are denied the use of the song because the politically correct say that it's offensive.
The never-ending fight over the song Dixie.
Look away.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Look away.
tonight at 10 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And again, we are talking about the crisis in Egypt. Last week, Mohamed Morsi, the president, was deposed by the military. He has been arrested, as have other members of the Muslim Brotherhood. There was a violent protest yesterday, something like 50 people killed and several hundred wounded. Joining us now as we continue our conversation is Daniel Kurtzer, professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He served as U.S. ambassador to Israel and to Egypt. That was from 1997 to 2001. His most recent book is Pathways to Peace, American and Arab-Israeli Conflict. And Dan Kurtzer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's good to be back.
Nice to have you with us as well. And also with us is Tariq Masood, an associate professor of public policy at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He writes about the Muslim Brotherhood. And Tariq Masood, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
Dan Kurtzer, if I could begin with you and just picking up on the picture that Kevin Connolly painted of this deepening crisis in Cairo and certainly in other parts of Egypt as well. What is your major concern as you watch events unfold?
Well, I think Kevin painted a very realistic and very sober picture of a situation that's volatile enough, can go in any direction. If there is continued street protests and if the Muslim Brotherhood decides to challenge the military, then this could actually deteriorate into what we would call a civil war. On the other hand, the military is going to try very hard to stabilize the situation, which I think is the first order of business. I think that was the effort the other day, which got out of hand. Mm-hmm. And then to provide some time for this interim political leadership to effect some constitutional reforms, call for elections, and try to move forward. Where Kevin is also right, however, is it would be, I think, a mistake to do this too fast, but also a mistake to do it too slow. The constitutional reforms are going to need to gain popular support. People will need to see that the elections are real. The opposition, so-called liberal opposition, needs time to get its act together. And the last 2 years doesn't give us a lot of hope that this can be done quickly.
I know, Tariq Masood, you have been in contact with members of the Muslim Brotherhood. What are you hearing from them?
Well, I'm hearing a couple of things. I mean, the first is that they very much view this as a military coup against a democratically elected president, and they are willing to go to some lengths to reverse this. Now, we've seen the lengths that they're willing to go to. They're basically walking in front of bullets. You know, one of the things, and I think it was Ambassador mentioned that, you know, the military is trying to stabilize the situation. I sort of see it very differently. I see the Muslim Brotherhood as engaging in largely peaceful protests, although there is some evidence that some individuals have showed up at these protests with guns. But that basically the what the military does not want is for these protests to continue, and therefore you're seeing the kind of massacre that we saw yesterday. And so I think that it actually becomes very hard. If the Muslim Brotherhood stays on its current course, I don't think we're going to see a civil war, because a civil war presupposes two sides that are armed, that are killing each other, kind of Algeria scenario. I think the Muslim Brothers are being much more savvy than that, and I think that they are willing to have a lot of their members die in the service of this, you know, democratic cause that they think they're pursuing. And so my feeling is that what is needed is not actually to stick to the current timeline that Egypt's rather unimaginative rulers, interim rulers, have now come up with, but really there needs to be some process that stops everything that is being done right now, where, you know, the idea now in Egypt is we're just going to forget that Mohamed Morsi was ever president, and we're going to move forward, and we've got a new president now, and we're going to find a new prime minister, and we're going to write a new constitution in 3.5 weeks. This is all just not going to work. And what needs to happen is, you know, the game needs to stop, and there needs to be some process where the Muslim Brotherhood and other political forces are brought to the negotiating table to actually sit down and figure out what's going to happen. Well, that may even mean that Mohamed Morsi comes back in some diminished capacity, is something I've been hearing from Muslim Brotherhood members. But I think this current scenario is just not going to work.
Well, let me just ask you a follow-up question. And Daniel Kurtz, I'd like to hear from you as well, your response to what Tariq Massoud just said. But to you, Tariq, I mean, who would stop the unrest, the protests that are taking place in Egypt today? Who has the clout, the authority to do that?
So it's, you know, if you think about the dynamics of these protests, they're really fascinating, because my strong sense is that the senior leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood would very much like to come to some negotiated agreement. However, their rank and file, the youth of the Muslim Brotherhood, are inflamed, okay? And you know, every one of them that I've spoken to, when I say, listen, just take care of yourself, don't get involved, and they say, how can I not, when Mohamed Morsi is remaining steadfast and is in custody, how can I not go out into the streets and call for a democracy? So I very much believe that the Muslim Brotherhood senior leadership is trapped because of their youth, and the youth are, you know, are going out there in part because Mohamed Morsi is in jail. He hasn't said anything. Not jail, but in custody.
Right.
So my feeling very strongly is that there is an agreement to be had here, and it would begin with Mohamed Morsi, you know, being released, making some kind of statement. But I think that the current situation, where the former Egyptian president is now somewhere where nobody knows where he is. I just think that there's just no way to lower the temperature with this kind of thing.
Well, Daniel Kurtzer, just picking up on that and what Tariq Massoud was just saying, do you agree that there could be some kind of negotiated resolution to this crisis that would include the Muslim Brotherhood and perhaps even President Morsi himself?
Look, Marty, if we were in a laboratory where we could, you know, freeze frame a situation, sure, everybody could take a step back and inhale and take a deep breath and figure out what to do next. But as we all know, this is a very dynamic situation in which both sides are not only thinking irrationally, but also acting so. Whether or not the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood wants to negotiate a solution, the words that they are uttering in public don't support that. And therefore, you have to take, at least at face value, the idea that they see this now as some kind of an ultimate battle between political Islam and the military in Egypt. And if that's the way it's being interpreted, and I think Tariq Massoud would understand this better than I, so I would defer to him on this. But as I'm listening to the Muslim Brotherhood leadership and the voices from the street, they are casting this in rather apocalyptic terms. It doesn't mean that this is their fault necessarily, but it makes it more understandable that the military is going to respond in apocalyptic terms. So if there is a moment here for people to step back while some degree of reason prevails, then it has to happen on both sides. One of the roles, for example, of the United States at this stage, and frankly, Marty, I know we're going to discuss this later, the United States' role, I think, is fairly limited here. But one of the roles of the United States can be to try to temper the efforts of the military to cast itself as the savior of the situation and as the only legitimate power in Egypt. The military has to step aside at some point. But in order to do so, both sides have to temper both the rhetoric and activities.
Let me reintroduce the two of you and also give out that phone number again. And that's Daniel Kurtzer, professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He was U.S. ambassador to both Israel and to Egypt. Wrote a book most recently called Pathways to Peace. Also joining us is Tariq Massoud, associate professor of public policy at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He writes about the Muslim Brotherhood, and we are talking about the the crisis in Egypt. I don't think I'm inflating that by calling it a crisis. And last Wednesday, President Mohamed Morsi was deposed by the military in Egypt, and there have been protests and some violent confrontations in the last week, and of course protests leading up to this as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Tarek, does it make sense to sort of lower the rhetoric on the crisis in Egypt from all sides?
Well, I think absolutely. I think the ambassador is absolutely right about that. I guess the question is, how realistic is it that we're going to get a solution here if the Muslim Brotherhood is not included and if Mohamed Morsi is not, you know, somehow released? Or it just seems to me that is one of the first things that needs to happen. I was expecting the military to, take Mohamed Morsi to his house and drop him off. I mean, that would have been much more effective than what they've done now in sort of neutralizing the Muslim Brotherhood. But I think it's just not realistic for us to assume that the situation can move forward in a constructive way, the way that the Egyptian military has currently set it up. So I think that, and I think it's important to note, and I think this is, if there's a disagreement between myself and the ambassador, I think it's here, in that, I absolutely agree with him that the Muslim Brotherhood is using apocalyptic rhetoric. But it's not, we're going to kill. It's, we're ready to be killed. Mm. And that's very different. Mm. And I think it's borne out in their behavior on the streets, where they are, as you saw, protesting in front of, military complexes and willing to walk in front of bullets. But that's what they're doing. So I think that it's tragic, and I would like to see that not happen. But I do think it suggests, that the movement is not quite as irrational or as bloodthirsty or out for revenge as one might make it out to be.
Daniel Kircher, going back to you, does it concern you, though, that it was the military that removed Mubarak, and now they have removed Mohamed Morsi? And as we know, the military is a long and powerful presence in Egypt, that they become the sort of autocratic ruler of that country.
Well, Marty, of course it's concerning, but it's not surprising. The military has been the arbiter of power in Egypt since the 1952 revolution. This has been a Praetorian regime, with the military preferring to sit behind the seat of power, but nonetheless influencing power. It doesn't justify it or make it right or make it preferable, but that's the reality of Egypt for the last more than 60 years. So it's not surprising at all that the military would have intervened 2 years ago, when Mubarak had stepped way beyond acceptable lines, including the possibility of his son succeeding him. And it's not surprising that the military would have stepped in now, when millions upon millions of Egyptians took to the streets to protest what actually was quite inept leadership on the part of Mohamed Morsi. Now, in this respect, just one comment on what Tarek Masoud mentioned earlier. I think he's exactly right that it's absolutely critical for the Muslim Brotherhood to be brought into the political dialogue and to remain as part of the political future of Egypt. It may be, however, a step too far to expect that Morsi himself is going to be rehabilitated. And here's where there may have to be some adjustments on the part of the Brotherhood. Morsi certainly, I think, should not be tried for treason, which is a report coming out of Cairo today. But it may be that he is so tarnished in practical political terms that there has to be a distinction drawn between bringing the Brotherhood back into the game and reinstating Morsi.
And I do want to have you pick up on that, Tarek Masoud, but I also want to throw out another issue, which I think is important to an American audience, which is the Obama administration, Daniel Kircher, seems very careful not to use the word coup. And I think coup is a loaded word, in that there is something like $1.4 billion attached to that potential, to that word. What do you make of what the Obama administration is and isn't doing and saying?
Well, the administration is, in fact, trying to toe a very fine line between what the law requires, which is the cutting off of military aid when the military intervenes in a coup or when a country recedes from democratic reforms, and, on the other hand, maintaining what is still a strategic relationship with an important country, Egypt. We still benefit from Egypt's adherence to the peace treaty with Israel. We still benefit from Egypt's providing intelligence and security assistance that's required for us in terms of our military deployments and our efforts against terrorism. So this is a difficult line for the administration to continue to toe. And you're going to find some very strange rhetorical formulations as they try to avoid using the word coup.
And you think smartly so?
I think it's the only option at this time. You know, it's very satisfying to be able to quote-unquote punish an offender. And the military here certainly is the offending party. But on the other hand, you know, countries act on the basis of self-interest, raison d'etat. And this is one of those cases where, you know, you swallow hard and you say, well, we still have a need for much of what Egypt provides to us. And we'd like them to be moving in the direction of democracy, but we have to work at that while we maintain the strategic tie.
Tariq Masood, what role do you think the U.S. should and can play in this crisis?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and I'm not sure I have anything to add that the ambassador didn't already say. I would say that response to the earlier point about Mohamed Morsi's reinstatement, I think the ambassador is right there as well. I think his release, though, would be a really good first step to building the kind of trust that's needed. And if the United States is to have a role, perhaps it's behind the scenes putting some pressure on the Egyptian government to do that, right? So it's one thing to overthrow this man, but let him go. Hmm. That might actually have an effect in calming down his supporters or in channeling their activities into something that's more constructive. But keeping them, I think, imprisoned in this way is damaging.
But do you think, Tariq, and this goes back to last fall, do you think Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood made a big mistake and there were, you know, essentially what has been described as a power grab?
Catastrophic mistake. Where I disagree with a lot of my colleagues who write about this is that I actually attribute 90% of this to Mohamed Morsi. And when Mohamed Morsi was elected in June, I wrote a couple of articles basically foreshadowing exactly what would happen, because I know Mohamed Morsi extremely well, and I know that he is not a compromiser and he is not democratic in his orientation. And he firmly believes that he is on the side of righteousness. So I was utterly unsurprised by his November constitutional declaration. I was utterly unsurprised by the kind of too clever by half hardball that he has played with the liberal opposition. So, for example, you probably heard that just shortly before his ouster, he had appointed a member of the Islamic group, a former terrorist organization, to be the governor of a city that organization had committed a brutal terrorist attack in 1997. And the reason he did this was because he had in fact offered the job to a liberal and they said no, and so he said, okay, I'm going to stick my finger in your eye and we're going to appoint this terrible guy instead. So Mohamed Morsi has been an unmitigated catastrophe.
Well, you know what, Tariq, hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a break and we'll be right back after this very short break talking about the crisis in Egypt. Stay with us.
The Chestnut Hill College School of Continuing and Professional Studies offers bachelor's and associate's degrees. Classes are scheduled on weekends and in the evenings with working professionals in mind to allow students to pursue a degree and a new career without putting the rest of their life on hold. Chestnut Hill College is holding an information session on Thursday, July 11th. Details online at chc.edu/visit. Chestnut Hill College is a proud supporter of WHYY. The Hamilton Public Media Commons Young Journalist Summer Camp is back at WHYY. Students in grades 9 through 12 will create video news stories and learn from award-winning journalists and media professionals, interviewing, shooting and editing video, and more. 2-week session starting August 5th. RSVP at whyy.org/camps. And young movie makers can submit entries for WHYY's Youth Media Awards now. Visit whyy.org/awards to learn more.
The rural Deep South, hotbed of HIV diagnosis.
This is the same virus, but a different disease in the South, and HIV really became much more of an indicator of fragile societies.
A look at how disease, race, and identity all contribute to this deeply rooted problem in the Deep South, next time on The Takeaway, from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco, and again, we are talking about the crisis in Egypt. After days of protests against President Morsi and his government, the military removed the president from power last week. This has led to violent clashes, including a confrontation yesterday in which 50 people were killed, hundreds wounded, outside a military barracks in Cairo. The Muslim Brotherhood has called for an uprising against the newly installed government. We're talking about all of this with Daniel Kurtzer, a former U.S. ambassador to Egypt. He's a currently professor at Princeton University. And Tariq Masood from Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Tariq, you were talking about Morsi as that you were more a critic. It sounds like you were more a critic of Morsi as president than the Muslim Brotherhood as an organization.
I think the Muslim Brotherhood as an organization also made several missteps, but I really locate the majority of the blame in the presidency. I think that if Mohamed Morsi hadn't made that constitutional declaration in November, a lot of this would not have happened. And I know for a fact that many senior leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood's political party, the Freedom and Justice Party, were really quite frustrated with Mohamed Morsi, but felt that they had to defend his decisions publicly. I think Mohamed Morsi was a terrible president. He's the worst man you could have picked in Egypt to be president of that country. However, you don't overthrow him. And that country's commitment to the principle of constitutionalism is, you know, razor thin as it is. And I think what's happened now only sets us up for future abuses against future constitutions. And I would note that the process that they put in place today for the writing of a new constitution, in which this thing is going to take 3.5 months, that is not a process that is going to lead to a document that's going to have any kind of public commitment. So I fear that much more of this kind of constitutional upheaval is in Egypt's future.
Well, picking up on that, Daniel Kurtzer, then we'll get to our callers. How then does whoever is in power in Egypt, how do they win over the confidence of the people, whether it is writing a new constitution, whether it is holding elections in 2014? That, you know, that's more than six months away. That seems like a long time when things are so fragile and chaotic.
Well, frankly, Marty, I think the only way that this process that was outlined by the interim president, Adli Mansour, would have any credibility is if a way could be found to bring the Muslim Brotherhood back to the table. And that's going to require some very heavy backroom bargaining and negotiating. Right now, the two sides' positions are quite hard. You know, there's still a lot of raw wounds from the confrontation yesterday and the killing of the 50 or so Muslim brothers at prayer. So it's not going to be easy to find a way in which the Brotherhood will come back to the table. Without that, then I think Tariq Masood is exactly right. However well-intentioned this constitutional reform process and the elections process is, it won't succeed because it will gain the support of only half of the Egyptian public. Remember, Morsi won election with about 51%, which means that about 49% of the public opposed him and not necessarily supported his opponent. And I think those numbers, you know, they may change a little bit here or there, but you'll still have a very divided society. This is a moment for backroom politics in which the army gets the Brotherhood into the room and tries to figure out what it is that would bring them back to the table into the process of reforming a constitution that was pushed through too quickly 8 months ago, which does need reform and which institutes a electoral process that hopefully can be free and fair.
And should the current U.S. ambassador to Egypt be in that back room with those players?
Well, whether she is or she isn't, she's going to be blamed by one side or the other for what happens. I was in Egypt in March and was joking around with our ambassador, Ann Patterson, saying, you know, everybody in the street believes that you are the strongest supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood. I thought she was going to throw me out of her office at the time. And, of course, now we're getting criticism from the Muslim Brotherhood because we have not cut off aid to the military. No, I don't think the American ambassador can actually be in the room with the military, the liberal society, and the Muslim Brotherhood. But we certainly have a role to play in whispering in the ear of at least two of those parties, and that's the military and the opposition, where we have to say to them that it will not work for them to do what the Brotherhood tried to do, which is to freeze out those with which they don't agree.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about Egypt, the crisis in Egypt, the impact inside that country, in the region, and of course for U.S. foreign policy as well. Talking with Daniel Kurtzer and Tariq Masood. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Haysom from, looks like Marlton, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, I have two things that I wanted to talk about. I just don't like the use of the word massacre by the military. And the other thing is that you guys are talking about shooting at them while praying. First of all, the Egyptian military is very disciplined. They know rules of engagement. They would not shoot at people while they're praying. This is the first point I wanted to make. The second point, and I'm giving you this example. If you are trying to attack the Defense Department here in the U.S. and not protest, attack it, what would the military do? They would open fire at you. Now, the Egyptian military, from people that were standing right in front of the building where the Muslim Brotherhood tried to attack, they have told me that the Egyptian military had been talking to them over loudspeakers, telling them to move away from the barbed wires. And then they shot in the air. And then when they start getting shot at by the Muslim Brotherhood, they start shooting at the lower, by their feet, by their at the lower portion of their body to push them away. The Muslim Brotherhood, they had the front lines attacking, and people were shooting from the back. And that had a lot of them getting injured that way because a lot of them were shot in the back, and that's how they start saying that they got shot while they were praying.
Well, you know what, Haysom, let me take your point, because as we heard from Kevin Connolly, and frankly, things that I've read, there are disputed reports about what actually happened there. But let me give Tariq Masood a chance to respond. Basically, Haysom is defending the military, saying this is what a military would do if a barracks is being attacked.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that what needs to happen, obviously, is an investigation and into exactly what happened, whether it was a Muslim Brotherhood attack or whether what the Muslim Brotherhood says is true. And maybe calling for such an investigation would be one measure of confidence building and goodwill building that this military could engage in this interim period.
What do you think, Daniel Kurtzer?
I think that's exactly right. Under ideal circumstances, you would want the investigation to include some kind of international involvement so that it has credibility. We know that the interim Egyptian president, Adli Mansour, has already called for an investigation, but I fear that no matter what outcome emerges from that investigation, it's going to be tainted because it's going to come from this interim government. The problem in Egypt is there's a tremendous amount of national pride, and I doubt that they will invite international observers or participants in the investigation. And therefore, Marty, we may be left with, who shot who outcome here.
And that, I guess, Daniel Kurtzer, could feed the unrest and mistrust in that country?
Well, sure. The investigation itself may prompt the next round of violence, because if it comes out and basically exonerates the military, saying that they were under attack, then the Muslim Brotherhood is going to be enraged. And on the other hand, if it blames the military, you will have very angry upper echelons of the military looking for some kind of retribution. This is not not going to end well.
Let me get to Ahmed from Edison to join us. Ahmed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, now I have I have 2 points. The first point is about why Morsi. Would me understanding and coming to the fact that Morsi has been a failure all over the year that he's been there, and also the Muslim Brotherhood, even before the year, in the way that they split from, you know, the opposition and everything. But also we have to understand that they were newly, you know, they were practicing a new experience to them, and they didn't have the experience. My point is now with understanding that Morsi had a lot of deficiencies, but now the media in particular in Egypt, the media that the night before the 25th of January, and you know, during the first revolution, or the revolution that took Mubarak out, this media was all the way with Mubarak's regime. Now, during the year that Morsi had ruled, this media, you cannot pick one single day that this media, specific channels you have on TV, I mean, you know, you can have a whole long list of them that haven't directed direct insults to Morsi's family, accusing them of all kinds of, you know, thievery, unlawful behavior, everything. And all most probably was full. Of course, they took advantage of a lot of mistakes, excuse me to say dumb mistakes that were done by these, you know, members of the Muslim Brotherhood, and also of the Morsi's thing and his random, you know, decisions that
let me take your point, which is, and again, Tariq, I'm going to toss this to you. His point being that the media, the press in Egypt was anti-Morsi, and even personal criticisms of the president, I guess, and his regime.
That was certainly one of Morsi's main talking points. If you listen to the speech that Morsi gave prior to the protests on June 30th, the speech, I believe, was on the 26th of June. He had a whole part of his two-hour speech was dedicated to the media, hectoring the media. And it's true that there was the state media that was not entirely cooperative with him, and then there was the private media that was owned by businessmen who were perhaps unhappy with Morsi for a variety of reasons, and so the coverage of Morsi was sort of like Fox News's coverage of President Obama, and Morsi felt that this was beyond the pale. I would also note, however, that the Islamists had their media. The Muslim Brotherhood had its channel, Egypt 25, etc., and those channels were also engaged in not only just pumping up the president, but towards the end in some sectarian rhetoric, very disturbing sectarian rhetoric. So nobody in this situation has covered themselves in glory or honor. The question for us is, now that we have this broken political system full of these unimaginative and really deficient political leaders, how can we get to a situation where we avoid bloodshed, we avoid you know, the complete collapse of the democratic experiment? And I think that's going to require some creativity, and maybe that's where the U.S. can have some influence. And I would just really quickly say that I sort of wish Ann Patterson had been the same kind of ambassador that Ambassador Kurtzer was. I think she became, by her own actions, far too much of a player and a public voice in the Egyptian dialogue at a time when, in fact, what they needed was exactly what the ambassador said, somebody whispering, as opposed to speaking as loudly and as openly as she did.
Daniel Kurtzer, do you want to say anything to Tariq Masood? Just gave you a big compliment.
Thank you for thank you for that shout-out. No, look, I think the reality now is that Ann Patterson has done about as good a job as could be expected. Probably would have been a little wiser to be a little more circumspect in some of the public comments. On the other hand, ambassadors reflect what the administration that hired them want them to reflect. And I think she was the kind of point person for an administration that wanted to say certain things about the evolution of democracy in Egypt, particularly at the backdrop of a Muslim Brotherhood government.
Well, and we're almost out of time here. We get to say that because there's so much more to talk about. But Daniel Kircher, you had mentioned the opposition. And do they bear any responsibility for the situation that Egypt is in today? And what role do you see them playing going forward?
Well, of course, everybody bears equal responsibility here. The opposition has proved very adept at mobilizing people to go out in the street to say what they don't want, but has proved totally inadequate in a proactive, positive agenda or in providing leadership in that regard. They couldn't field a single, a sole candidate in the elections in order to contest those elections. There was a diffusion of power at that point among the opposition, and they're still pretty much beset by both internal divisions and a lack of organization. Mohamed El-Baradei, who's being talked about as a possible prime minister, at least until a couple days ago, may be the only figure that people can agree upon in the opposition, but he is not the strongest figure that one would hope for in this situation. So it suggests that the opposition itself, badly fragmented, has a lot to answer for in terms of the perpetuation of this crisis.
Well, as I said, we could go on much more to talk about. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Daniel Kircher, as always, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome. He's professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He was U.S. ambassador to Israel and also to Egypt. And Tariq Masood, thank you very much as well.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. He's an associate professor of public policy at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. And we began our conversation with Kevin Connolly, BBC Middle East correspondent. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including a Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, podcasts, and Sirius Satellite Radio. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.